A big bank bailout for Spain.
Is it just another Band-Aid for Europe's debt crisis?
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Monday, June 11th.
Coming up, how did California's budget problems escalate so quickly?
What's the next big thing from Apple?
And if your password is 123456, it might be time for a change.
Yeah, those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Worries persist about the financial health of Spain, even after the European Union's $125 billion bailout of Spanish banks over the weekend. Yields on Spanish government bonds have now moved back above 6% after dropping earlier today, a sign that investors are still wary and demand an extra premium if they're going to buy the stuff. The BBC's Tom Burridge is in Madrid. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
$100 billion is always nice for a banking system, but beyond that, what is the significance of all this money?
Well, I mean, I think what we've seen really is Spain being hurried along by other European leaders. Spain, up to the last minute this weekend, was insisting it would wait a bit longer for an independent audit on the banking system to come back. That hasn't happened, and I think that's because there is pressure from other Eurozone countries to get this problem sorted before, of course, the Greek elections next weekend.
This is good for the banks, clearly, but what about the Spanish government? One hopes that the government itself won't need a bailout sometime soon.
Yeah, well, the Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, yesterday said exactly that. He said that if Spain hadn't carried out all the reforms it had to date before this bailout, then actually what we would have seen was a bailout of the country, in his words. But it did secure a deal which has very different conditions to those of Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. Spain will not have the interference in terms of its tax and spend policies as those other countries, and that's crucial. The reforms and the conditions will relate to the financial sector because the money, the Eurozone money, will go to troubled Spanish banks.
Tom Burridge, BBC Madrid, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's get some reaction to this Spanish bailout from right here in New York. Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us as she is every Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it looks kind of like another Band-Aid for Europe, I have to say, another big bailout to kind of buy time to deal with the debt crisis.
Absolutely. So this is an effort to buy a little insurance and limit contagion ahead of the Greek elections that are coming up next weekend. And you're right, the plan lacks details and it raises nearly as many questions as it answers. So it really is just buying a little time, sending the signal that the Eurozone does stand behind its biggest countries and therefore hopefully there won't be a panic after the Greek elections.
Well, when you look at the European crisis right now, it does start to look a little bit more like what we had back in 2008, unfortunately. There are just all these different things happening at the same time, and you're just watching these bailouts go from one place to the other to the other.
Yeah, well, and in fact, you know, what one could argue is that European policymakers have been overly complacent, and maybe part of that reflects the fact that they really haven't experienced what we went through in 2008, where we really were in a free fall in financial markets, in the economy. It really was, you know, the end of life as we knew it, it seemed.
Right.
And so policymakers took aggressive action, whereas they've been kind of able to kick the can down the road, muddle along in this kind of piecemeal fashion for a while now.
Well, what are you going to be watching for as we head into those Greek elections this weekend, which, of course, could lead to a Greek exit from the euro?
Well, what we're looking for is there a clear enough outcome for the centrist parties that looks like they can form a coalition that will in turn renegotiate the terms of the Greek bailout and maintain them as a Eurozone participant? If, on the other hand, the extremist parties gain traction, then we're going to be facing some pretty bad fallout Monday morning.
Well, we'll be talking to you about it, I'm sure, next Monday. Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks, as always.
It's a pleasure.
Well, whenever these bailouts happen, whether for banks or for countries, there's a question of moral hazard. If you bail someone out, do others stop trying to fix their own problems and assume they will be bailed out as well? Reporter Christopher Wirth has that part of the story.
Think of moral hazard like this. If your neighbor were to stop paying their mortgage, but the bank forgave them and let them keep the house, wouldn't everyone on your block want the same deal? In this case, since Spanish banks got a bailout without the government having to impose new spending cuts, will other European countries see an opportunity? Stefan Schneider is a chief economist at Deutsche Bank.
You are risking that other countries are saying, okay, if country A got a better deal, we want to have a better deal.
Take Greece, which heads into an election next week. Some candidates are saying they want to stay in the euro, but without the tough budget cuts. But Schneider says Spain's bailout shows that countries that work to control their deficits, like Spain has done, will be rewarded with favorable terms.
It's a good incentive and not a moral hazard at all.
Philip White of the Center for European Reform says there are times when it's right to be concerned about moral hazard, and there are times when it's not.
You know, the Eurozone is possibly weeks or months away from breakup. And it seems to me that the middle of an existential crisis is a very dangerous time to be excessively worried about moral hazard.
In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The ratings agency Moody's could lower credit ratings on the bonds of several U.S. banks this month. The downgrades could send ripples throughout the economy, but not the tidal waves we might have seen just a few years ago. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Moody's has been on a world tour of downgrades since February. They've hit big banks in Japan and Europe. Next stop, the U.S., says finance professor David Byam at Columbia Business School.
It is part of a larger pattern in which banks have been knocked down from their rather high pedestal that they were on some years ago. It is a time when the financial industry, I think, is undergoing a very important and overdue transition.
A transition to an investing world where ratings agencies are supporting acts, not the headliners. Investors used to treat, say, Moody's rating of J.P. Morgan as the reason to buy or sell. That thinking played a role in the financial crisis. Those ratings are now just one song on an album of tunes that investors listen to. Stephen Lewis at Monument Securities says the ratings agencies never wanted so much power over investors.
And that was not always a comfortable position to be in. And so I think they wanted to get out of that situation, which they have done.
But he says giving ratings agencies a smaller stage is just one step in stabilizing the markets. I'm Eve Troe from Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Lawmakers in California have until the end of the week to plug a $16 billion budget deficit. That's a much bigger gap than the $9 billion the governor estimated just months ago. Well, how did the problem escalate so quickly like this? Here's Ben Adler of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento.
The biggest reason for the deficit jump is a whole bunch of money the state planned on getting never showed up. Now, you might think there's a pretty simple explanation for that.
It's the economy, stupid.
It's the economy, stupid.
It's the economy, stupid.
But actually, just about everyone agrees it's not. First of all, taxes on capital gains and corporations came in way short of projections. Here's how Democratic Governor Jerry Brown explained things a couple of weeks ago.
The capitalist system is not coincident with your expectations of exactitude. It doesn't play like we may want it to.
But the governor and legislative Democrats did project an extra $4 billion in revenue in last year's budget. From the start, Republicans called it wishful thinking. Senate Minority Leader Bob Huff.
There were unrealistic assumptions made last year. Obviously, the most notable was the $4 billion that magically appeared when they were that far apart from closing the budget.
Beyond the revenue, a lot of other things didn't work out either. Federal judges and the Obama administration rejected some Health and Human Services cuts, and it turns out schools are owed more than originally thought, thanks to the state's incredibly complex education funding formula. Here's Governor Brown.
The budget has hundreds of funds. We have lots of restraints and rules, and figuring out is not just showing up and saying, okay, we got to $8 billion gap, let's start cutting like someone in business. It's a pretzel palace of incredible complexity.
A palace that now has a gaping hole ripped right through it. In Sacramento, I'm Ben Adler for Marketplace.
Since the Syrian uprising began in March last year, tens of thousands of people have fled the country. Some went to Jordan, others to Lebanon, and according to officials, at least 27,000 to Turkey. From Istanbul, Ashley Creek reports on one man's effort to help those fighting against the Syrian regime.
A small private hospital in the suburbs of Istanbul. Two Syrian men lie here injured, but they think lucky. Because when the revolution started, Dr. Alan Nazir, a Syrian doctor who's lived in Istanbul for 30 years, decided he'd treat wounded Syrians for free.
Every Syrian one who didn't help the Syrian in this position, for sure he's a traitor. Most of the revolutions, they aren't rich, they are poor, so it's hard to take from them.
But Dr. Nazir and his nephew Khaled, who works with him, learned a few months ago that some patients had bills. They were shocked.
One man called my uncle and he asked him to decrease the cost for the guys here. He said to my uncle, a bill come to me that you want $25,000. My uncle said to him, I did not want any money from anyone. Everything is free here.
Apparently, a middleman had been ripping off some patients. Khaled said his uncle has tried to make sure everyone knows not to pay any bills, and he hopes his family's reputation has not been tarnished by this.
A lot of people trying to steal money using our names, so our names will be bad between our friends. Some of people will think it bad, or Khaled and doctor trying to write a big bills. That's not true, you know? Not true.
The Syrian opposition in Istanbul is small and close-knit, with about 800 volunteers. The exiles run a number of groups that send aid to Syria. In the basement of an office building in Istanbul, Magira Al-Sharif volunteers with the Syrian Solidarity Association.
Here you go.
He wrestles through boxes of T-shirts and bracelets and lighters.
A lighter, we had a lighter. This is for 10 liters. We can make 100 liters out of 10.
Over the past 5 months, the group has sent $100,000 to Syria. Al-Sharif says they know there's a lot of graft, especially at the border among smugglers. So they only send money with people they know. And so far, they haven't been ripped off. In Istanbul, I'm Ashley Cleek for Marketplace.
A slew of economic indicators from China over the weekend were downbeat. Factories there were quieter, retail sales down, the list goes on. But there was one interesting surprise. Overseas shipments from China are up more than 15% over last year. That's double what the experts were predicting. We asked Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz to find out why.
With so much doom and gloom out there in the global economy, a boost in Chinese exports doesn't seem to compute. Shanghai-based economist Andy Rothman was surprised.
Exports to the United States were up 23% year on year last month. To the ASEAN countries, up 28%. Japan, up 13%.
Even exports from China to the EU were up more than 3% despite the economic crisis there. So what does this say about the U.S. economy?
It says that, you know, U.S. economy is not doing as badly as many people had thought. But again, you don't want to put too much reliance on just 1 month's worth of data. Over the course of the year, though, Chinese exports to the U.S. had been holding up relatively well.
Rothman says these numbers may be encouraging, but export growth is a small part of China's GDP calculation. What's more important is that exports don't collapse as they did a few years ago, causing 20 million layoffs. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
In Dubai, there's mounting concern about the health of 20 British businessmen imprisoned for bouncing checks. The men have been on a hunger strike for several weeks to protest the length of their sentences. The Financial Times says many of the men had been involved in Dubai's property market, which collapsed in 2009. The trust surrounding checks is central to the financial system in the United Arab Emirates. One man who's been refusing food for 7 weeks now was convicted of bouncing 49 checks and got 20 years.
The Apple Worldwide Developers Conference kicks off in San Francisco today. That's the event where the CEO of Apple stands up on a stage in front of a big screen and unveils the company's new products. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has a preview.
Last year's conference was the last hosted by Steve Jobs. This year, CEO Tim Cook will be making the big product splashes. Analyst Peter Misek at Jefferies expects newly designed laptops, perhaps a new Apple TV, and the latest operating system for mobile devices.
We think it'll have deep Facebook integration, be all about video.
Misek says there are more Android devices out there, but Apple, with its unified platform and tight quality control through the App Store, is the most coveted market for developers.
So imagine developing for 350 million people. Your immediacy of revenue is much higher.
I went to a Mac store here in Portland to find out what the app aficionados want.
App that would categorize expiration dates for the items in your refrigerator.
A self-quantification app. How often you write or read or drink.
So if someone hasn't already done these, hey, developers, knock yourselves out. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For today's Midday Extra, a follow-up on something we asked you about last week, what does the middle class look like? You got a bunch of your photographs with some really great stories about being middle class, like one from Steve Haupt in Clarksburg, California.
It's a two-story appearing house with a high-pitched roof, blue with white trim. Then off to the right of the picture, you'll see our horse barn.
Haupt lives in the home with his wife.
My wife and I, we saved our whole marriage to build this place. And it's what we built with our own hands. All the years of sweat and savings to build everything that you see in that picture. And it's ours. It's what Americans aspire to, having something of their own.
Haupt says that's what it means to be middle class. It's working hard, saving, setting a goal, and getting there.
Look for a better thing in the future. Something's better, and we're working towards it. And so I think that helps define middle class for us.
Show us what you think it means to be middle class. You can go to marketplace.org to upload your photo. Look for the link that says Middle Class Photo Project.
And now this program note, David, we don't often remind people to do this, but if you are a big fan of the Marketplace Midday Update podcast, or if you don't like it at all, you can go onto iTunes and rate it so we have some sense of what you think of it and what you'd like to see differently. And finally, the social networking site LinkedIn was hacked last week, and more than 6 million passwords were stolen, David, and some of them posted on the web. Turns out we now know what some of the most common passwords for LinkedIn are. The number one was link. That's pretty easy to remember. Number two, 1234.
The old standby.
The old standby. Number three was 12345.
Aha, uh-huh, clever.
Number four was, you guessed it, 123456. So some really serious security in the passwords on LinkedIn. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.